We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3593. And we've got dash four amendments. John, can you explain the amendments, please?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Starr, excuse me, and members of the committee. House Bill 3593 is our second hearing that we're having on this bill today. Last time the speaker testified on this bill, we did have the proposed dash four before us. Let's review again for you. It changes the current penalty system from a criminal penalty to a civil penalty, increases penalty minimum from $100 to $500, and from a maximum of $3,000 to $5,000, creates new ODOT interest-bearing account known as the Grade Crossing Safety Improvement Fund, allows ODOT to determine on a case-by-case basis setback distances for crossings with double tracks with a provision for a hearing process, also allows ODOT to prohibit crossing blockages at certain crossings and provides for a hearing process, and also a major change in the original bill is this eliminates the blockage crossing penalty amounts from $7,000 to $10,000. There is no revenue impact on the bill. You should have a copy of your fiscal statement. One last time, and I've included another copy this time, members. I'm hearing a rumor, I don't know how accurate it is, that possibly the fiscal that you had before you on the original bill could possibly go up with this dash four amendment, but I'm not certain yet on that. Claudia Heller will be here to clarify that. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you very much. Everett Cutter, Dave Barrows. Members, you had a statement at your spot from the speaker, his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Everett Cutter, manager of the Oregon Railroad Association. I represent the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroads that operate in the state of Oregon. With me this morning are Carolyn Larson and a Union Pacific attorney who represents the railroad on many crossing cases.
Everett, can you move that microphone closer or speak a little more into it?
Yes, sir. And Mr. Larry Lee, who's manager of operating practices and operating officer with the Union Pacific Railroad in Eugene, Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity this morning to address some of our concerns with House Bill 3593. As introduced, the bill proposed some very far-reaching and impossible elements that would have imposed very severe restrictions on railroad operations in the state of Oregon. Amendments have been developed to try to deal with some of the questions that were raised. And I would like to speak today to the dash three amendments, or now dash four. We have dash four amendments. Actually, the dash four changed only one word, and it is an appropriate change. These amendments do represent significant improvements over the original bill, as I stated, but we do have very serious reservations about several elements of the dash four amendments. Proposed amendments explicitly give the state powers to regulate the blocking of public railroad highway grade crossings and to regulate setback distances for stopping or parking railroad equipment, in addition to the previous jurisdiction over time limits for trains blocking crossings. In each of these three areas, fines for violations are raised or established at a minimum $500 and maximum $5,000 for each offense. We agree that citations should be civil penalties rather than criminal, as provided by this bill, and there is connectivity in directing penalties collected into grade crossing safety improvement projects. But we would argue that the proposed fines, the magnitude of the fines, is excessive and out of line with other states, and I think Ms. Larson can speak to that in her remarks. We're also concerned with the prospect of the possibility of proliferation of widespread variations in equipment setback requirements. The general rule under operating rules is 250 feet setback. In some cases, it is farther by agreement in particular instances, but we would be concerned if we had many variations from the basic 250-foot. Statewide uniformity should be the goal insofar as possible, rather than railroads having to deal administratively with crossing-by-crossing differences. Our greatest concern, Mr. Chair, members, our greatest concern with the proposed language is that allows a person, any individual, to require a hearing to be held regarding crossing blockage, stopping, or equipment setback distances. This would vastly increase the likelihood for frivolous hearings that could become very costly for railroads and for the state. This prospect could be especially onerous for Oregon's struggling short line railroads, which could suffer significant economic impact even if they prevail in a case. I will turn further remarks over to Mr. Lee, who has some operating considerations to address, and Ms. Larson, who can talk more about the crossing blocking fines and other aspects of the bill. I'd be happy to answer questions now or at the conclusion of our presentation.
Let's get all the testimony and then we'll ask questions.
Good morning. My name is Larry Lee, and I'm a manager of operating practice with the Union Pacific Railroad. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my purpose here today is to address the operating issues of the Union Pacific Railroad and to give a little history of what the crews do that work on those trains and some of the problems that are involved with those crews. In many cases, we look at train or blockage of crossings as a simple issue, and I'm here to tell you that it's not. It's my job to supervise the crews that work out on the road, and the train and engine crews do not block crossings because they want to. It's normally, if that happens, it's an operating problem. It's a switching problem. It's not something that a crew that goes out there and goes to work just pulls up and blocks a crossing and does not worry about it. We have operational side, we have meeting trains is one of our biggest problems. We have more trains in the corridor today than we had years before. These trains are longer than they were years before. Whenever we're out there switching either in a yard or on the main line, we have more types of cars. Our shippers are getting more and more types of cars every year, and it's taking longer to sort these cars out when we put a train together or we're out on a main track situation. And in most cases, this is because of safety. We have certain types of cars that can be next to certain types of cars, and it's impossible to just pick up 20 cars, put them onto your train, and go, where in past that was something that could be done. Now with all the various types of cars, this is very hard to do. The second problem we have is that we're having more switching on the main track or main line. We have customers out on the main line that have more and more needs, and these trains are stopping out there to pick up these various cars from these shippers, and it has increased the switching that we do out there on the main track. One other thing that it seems by someone looking in from the outside that cutting a crossing would be a simple thing to do. Well, it's more involved and it's more time consuming than it looks. If a train pulls into a crossing or into a siding and blocks a crossing to meet another train and then something happens to that other train, the idea that they can go back and cut that crossing very efficiently and very quickly is not true. In many cases, it takes 20, 30, 40 minutes for a conductor to get off the head of an engine, walk back to where that crossing is, close the angle cocks, open the pin, pull that train ahead. Now, even though that conductor now has cleared that crossing for whatever the reason is of their delay, when the train that they're waiting for does arrive and all the traffic has cleared and they put that train back together, this conductor now is anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes or 10 minutes, depending on how far back the crossing is, from the head of his train. He still or she still has to put that train back together, They have to make sure that there's air throughout that train. Then that conductor has to walk back up, him or her, to the head end of their train. And this is a time-consuming process, especially you're not walking on pavement. You're walking on ballast. And in many cases, walking on ballast is always longer than walking on any kind of level service. That's all I have, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Starr, members of the committee. I'm Carolyn Larson, attorney for Union Pacific Railroad. I would like to direct my comments specifically to the issue of increased fines and to the an individual's right to seek a hearing on imposing special rules at individual crossings. As to the increased fines, these appear punitive to me and unnecessarily so. As Mr. Lee has testified, blockages are not an intentional act of the railroad or something that can be easily avoided. They're difficult to avoid. Between Salem and Portland, for instance, there are only five sidings, only five places where trains can pass each other, and only two of those are free of crossings, the two that are closest to Salem. So anytime there is a meet between trains northerly of those two sidings, there is the potential for a blockage if the timing isn't perfect and the trains aren't timed exactly so that there's less than 10 minutes that one train sits in the siding. This is something which the railroads do try to control with their scheduling, but it isn't perfect. And with so few opportunities to pass trains, that's a problem. It, you know, basically, crossing blockages occur because there aren't enough places long enough to hold a train where there aren't crossings. So, you know, we try to work to consolidate or eliminate crossings so that there are enough spaces. But
Ms. Larson, yeah. How many of those, when those trains stop, how many of those crossings are dead-end streets where safety is really an issue?
I can't tell you that because we don't have them categorized by that kind of information. But I know that one of the sidings, actually two of the sidings have quite a few are private crossings, so they just serve one house. The private crossings aren't covered by the blockage rules, but we still don't like to block them anyway because we know that people live there and want to get in and out. Sometimes even when it's not a dead-end road, it still can be a very long, circuitous route to get around anyway, so it's not simply the matter of whether it's dead-end or not that there are issues that...
Do you think that this bill and these amendments, how they're drafted, are really intended to impact and affect the situation that you just explained?
They will affect that, yes.
Do you think that's the intent of these amendments?
Well, I'm not so much concerned about what the intent was, but how they will get applied in the future. I think that there is not necessarily a hostile or punitive intent, but the effect is going to be still very hard on railroad companies who aren't intentionally blocking crossings, but find themselves in the position that that's what happens.
And you're not satisfied that the department, this is not a mandate the department does certain things, that the word may is used in the amendment. You don't think that the department will work with the railroad, recognizing scheduling, recognizing the circumstances the railroad's faced with?
Well, with the present ODOT staff, I do believe that they will work with us, but I don't know what might happen in the future. We do get fined the maximum $3,000 quite frequently now, so if the maximum goes up to $5,000, I would think the staff would believe that the legislature has given a directive that level is an appropriate one for issuing a fine.
How many $3,000 fines have you received in the last 2 years?
Can I take a wild guess?
Sure.
I would say 75.
75, $3,000 fine.
I would say so.
My question is, apparently that's 75 times that the department has believed that for whatever reason you blocked a right of way for too long of a period of time. Apparently that's okay with the railroad, and $3,000 fines isn't enough to motivate the railroad to not block the right-of-ways, or is it just kind of the cost of doing business and you can't get around it?
Well, most of those are times where there was a long blockage in terms of time. Right now, the department has a sliding scale where it does impose a longer, a higher fine if the blockage is for a longer period of time. But actually, I would say that most of those have happened in an area where we're putting in an overpass because it's just a very difficult situation. We've got, I would say that 80% of the blockages that Union Pacific gets fined on are in an area where we'll have a solution in 11 or 12 months as soon as that overpass is put in. It's a problem where it's at the throat of a railroad yard, and there are so many train movements going in and out of that area that sometimes that the blockages are just very large in number. So it's been a problem. I mean, it's I think that some of the blockages, certainly the department doesn't fine us a huge amount because they realize we have. It's very clear that there was no choice for the railroad. Others, it's harder to in retrospect figure out what happened. And if the blockage is long, it's just been they've used the sliding scale to impose the fine. Comparing this to other states, right now Oregon at $3,000 per blockage, that's a higher fine than any other state in the union. The closest that I've found are Delaware, where they've got a $2,000 fine. Illinois has $1,000. Louisiana has up to $1,000. Michigan up to $1,000. So already Oregon.
In those other states, are those criminal penalties as they are in Oregon under current statute? Or are those civil statutes? Civil penalties.
I'm looking at a chart that was prepared by the Federal Railroad Administration, and it doesn't necessarily give that information.
Okay.
Well, Illinois, I said 1,000 for Illinois. It's a fine of between 200 and 1,000 plus another $500 for each 5 minutes over 35 minutes. In Oregon, we would definitely be charged the maximum $3,000 before we got to 35 minutes.
Other questions? Representative Verger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It isn't so much a question, but I'd like for you to comment on it. We had about a $2.5 million project in the right down on the waterfront in the city of Coos Bay, and we had great difficulty with the railroad because the entrance to the boardwalk was blocked by a long train. And so we asked the railroad very politely to please not do that because we wanted tourists to be able to go on the boardwalk. It took actually a change in the ownership or a change in the short line. And once the new short line came in, we've never had a problem since. So there could be something here that there is a little bit more of an effort in some companies than in others. You might like to comment on that. They had plenty of track. Now, why they refused for the first 6 months to do that, I don't know, but we certainly not had a problem since. I like that solution of government being able to deal with the railroad and having a nice, polite compromise. And ours was not safety. It was strictly to get them. It is a two-line. There are two tracks there, but there would not be another train coming, so it was not a matter of safety.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, to address that particular issue, the short line has a much different cost basis than a Class 1 railroad. And when you changed from a Class 1 railroad to a short line, you had management on property, and you had more people in that area that were working for the railroad. On a Class 1 railroad, you'd have one train go over a day, do their switching and leave, and there would be not a crew in that area till the next day. Most of that was simply on a cost basis for what it costs a Class 1 to operate. When you turn to a short line operation, you have people that would follow the trains and automobiles and various other things, but that was because their costs were considerably lower and they had more people in that area.
I see.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask a little bit about the testimony, Mr. Cutter. You said you would like to have a uniform standard throughout the state. My impression was the original bill was a uniform standard of 500 feet, and then I thought it was part of a negotiation with the railroads not to have such a uniform standard, and yet now your testimony is saying you'd rather have a uniform standard. I'm a little confused.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, the railroads, as far as I know, were not a party to the discussions leading to the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments.
Then let me ask this clarification, Mr. Chair. Would you prefer to have a straight 500 feet? What was in the original bill was preferable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, no. The standard for the nation is 250 feet. And 500 feet would be an exception, such as was voluntarily agreed to by the Union Pacific Railroad in the particular crossing case that gave birth to this particular bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the bill would give Oregon Department of Transportation authority to regulate these setback distances, and our concern is you have 250 feet here, 300 feet there, 400 feet there, 500 feet there, you know, this kind of a proliferation that we would have to live with and keep track of and administer.
It sounds then like this is halfway between the best and worst cases for you. The best case is 250 feet, the worst case is the original bill at 500, and this is somewhere in between.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, yes, as I say, this represents significant progress in the right direction, but we still have these concerns.
Just note, I originally thought, well, 250 feet sounds like a long ways, and not quite the length of a football field, but a good distance, until I did a little calculation and realized that a train coming through at about 60 miles an hour, maybe your trains don't travel that fast, we're talking basically about 3 seconds, and I can see how crossing a double crossing, especially if the view is obstructed by a train that is parked there, that 3 seconds isn't a lot of time, and I can see that it's a challenge. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Do you have anything further? Thank you very much. Let's have Dave Barrows now, and let's bring Walt Brickweedle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, and I would like to express our appreciation to the speaker for his efforts to improve the original bill. It is an improvement. We were, however, we did not negotiate this. These were just improvements that he made and handed to us, which is obviously his right. Two or three things that are continue to concern us. The increase of the maximum fine is a concern. We do support the change from criminal to civil. That's kind of almost a no-brainer. As far as the determination crossing by crossing, that's a great concern. There is a general code of operating rules nationally, which everyone pretty much abides by and looks to, and in those rare cases where there has to be an exception, there's a process whereby an exception can be established. We should not have a situation where we're dealing crossing by crossing. That will be very expensive and not necessarily particularly productive. The greatest concern we have, as Mr. Cutter and others have pointed out, is the ability of an individual to cause a hearing. And while, Mr. Chair, you're correct that it is permissive in Section 3, it is mandatory in Section 4. And this will be expensive. This will cost the state money. I cannot believe that the fiscal on this will be the same as the original bill. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but my belief is that where individuals And I would make it analogous, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to what is known as a private right of action in enforcing other laws, primarily environmental laws. And that's very expensive, and it would be very expensive in this case because any individual could force a hearing. This will cost ODOT money. This will cost the railroads money. We have to pass that on. And we just don't think that's an appropriate way for the statutes to read. There is currently in statute the ability of any individual, Mr. Chairman, to bring to ODOT's attention or to the local government's attention a problem and have those governmental entities look at it, investigate it, and deal with it if it's appropriate. But for an individual to be able to absolutely, in all cases without exception, force a hearing, we don't think is the appropriate way to go. Again, we want to thank the speaker for his efforts to improve what was truly a difficult bill for the industry, but we still have grave concerns, as been expressed by Mr. Everett and by the Union Pacific. Thank you.
If were you aware that the bill was being worked on and invited to negotiate or work with the group that was working on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, we were aware, we were told that there would be amendments. To my knowledge, there was no group that worked on it. And I certainly wasn't invited to any meeting. I don't believe Mr. Cutter was invited to any meeting, and I don't believe Union Pacific was. And again, that's not a criticism. The sponsor of a bill gets to work the bill any way he wants to. But we have no ownership of these amendments. We have no input in them. And they are an improvement, no question about it. They're just not there yet.
If in section 4 on line 21 of the amendments we replace may, shall with may, that alleviate a certain amount of heartburn?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it would alleviate a certain amount. It still couldn't get us to supporting the bill.
You don't want to make a bad bill better in your estimation.
Right.
I can appreciate
that. That is an adage that has been said in this building a time or two.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. I'm Walt Brickwedell, president of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association. I wrote to each member of this committee on April 3rd on behalf of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, urging you to oppose House Bill 3593 in its original form, as it was extremely detrimental to Oregon's short line railroad industry. The latest proposed amendments to this bill, 3-4 now, alleviate some of our concerns, and I thank those who worked on this amendment for listening to us. However, one new paragraph of the 4 amendments creates another concern for our industry, as was mentioned here today. That's line 9 under section 1 and line 19 under section 4 declares that a person may petition the Department of Transportation to investigate and hold a hearing. If that person, now presumably any person, is unhappy with the length of time that a public grade crossing is blocked or unhappy with the distance from a crossing that a train stops or rail equipment is parked. Now, while Oregon's short line railroads recognize the authority of the Department of Transportation to regulate these matters, as it does now, it should not result in further regulation resulting from inexpensive investigation and hearing prompted by one individual's response or experience. As you know, Oregon's 19 short line railroads typically operate in rural communities on former branch lines of the Class 1 or large railroads. These tracks were designed and maintained to serve industries, which in many cases are an integral part of the community, where public grade crossings next to these industries are very common. Further restrictions on the blocking of crossings or setting new stopping distances from particular crossings in some areas may actually prevent our industries from using rail service. We also are concerned that if standards are permitted to vary by crossing, it would be difficult to monitor by our railroads. And failing to do so now would result in even stiffer penalties as well. Further regulation of the rail industry under House Bill 3593-4 will undoubtedly cause Oregon's short line railroads to give up valuable track space to store equipment or to hold cars for customers, or to actually perform switching operations when those tracks are located near a public crossing. Restrictions on any one of these operations will certainly have a severe economic impact on the short line industry in Oregon. For these reasons, the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association once again urges you to oppose the HB 3593-4 as it is written. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Question for either one of you. Would you prefer that the penalties in the statute remain criminal, or do you prefer the change to a civil penalty?
Mr. Chair, as I testified, my company much prefers the change from criminal to civil. I think the department would function better not having to deal with an assistant AG, and we think it makes a lot of sense. As I indicated, I think it's almost a no-brainer.
Chair Starr, the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association also wishes that those penalties be made civil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Walt, can you give me a specific example of a short line that would be affected by the crossing requirement, the 500-foot mark? How would that affect, if you have a siding that's within a very short-sighted distance of a crossing, give me a practical application of what this bill would do.
Representative Krupp, Chair Starr, I can speak specifically for Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad, the railroad that I'm affiliated with and the largest railroad in a short line railroad in the state of Oregon. There are two specific customers that immediately come to mind. One is in Notai, Oregon, it's Swanson Superior Forest Products, and another one is in Glendale, that is Superior Forest, Superior Lumber. Both of those industries are adjacent to a public crossing. They're not signalized crossings, but they are public crossings. In the case of Swanson Superior, we must place cars just beyond the crossing because there isn't sufficient space to on that spur to get to that particular industry. So we try to maintain the industry standard of 250 feet. 500 feet would certainly prohibit us from serving that customer. And a letter was sent to members of the committee from Swanson Superior indicating that. In Glendale, Superior Lumber, one of our largest customers, has a number of tracks going into their facilities because they manufacture and ship a variety of commodities. We place cars on sidings in Glendale, which used to be at one time a yard. There are two public crossings that we have to place cars between, and Superior actually comes out with their own switch engine and performs the switching into their plant. So what we do is stage the cars for them adjacent to our main line. If we had to adhere to a 500-foot clearance, for example, we would only perhaps be able to place in two or three cars instead of the 10 cars that they normally get.
So, Mr. Chair, so then with the dash fours, where it takes away the 500-foot requirement and just allows ODOT to determine what the setback distances are on a case-by-case basis, then your concern about the 500-foot issue in these types of circumstances pretty much goes away, correct?
Representative Krupp, Chair Starr, yes, it does.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair, the real problem sounds like both of you have, even with the Dash 4 amendments, is that any person can make a complaint and begin this process.
Representative Krupp, Chair Starr, that is our major concern. Yes, it is.
Mr. Chair, could I also speak to that? And that is, we would like some recognition in this bill or on the tape or something about the General Code of Operating Rules, and some recognition that ODOT is to follow that as much as possible, with the exceptions being rare, necessary but rare, rather than starting each crossing evaluation kind of with a blank piece of paper. And I mean, these are nationally recognized rules that the all Class 1 railroads, and perhaps short lines, I don't know about that, operate under, and that would be helpful if there was some way that these could be recognized.
We'll ask Claudia when she comes up.
Okay.
If that's possible. Dave, were you contacted by the Speaker's office at all since this bill was introduced? Have any conversations with them regarding this bill how it might be improved?
Mr. Chair, I have had conversations both with the Speaker's assistant, Mrs. Simmons, and with the Speaker himself about it. And I've expressed the concerns that I've expressed to the committee today about the Dash 3s then. And but I was not contacted in the context of, let's sit down and try and figure out a path to victory.
But they did listen to your concerns and to a certain extent incorporated those into the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I think that's fair to say.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both for your testimony.
Yeah, thank you.
Irv, can I ask the same question of you? Could you come back up, Irv Petter? The question is, since this bill was first introduced, you had conversations with the Speaker's office, the Speaker personally, regarding your objections to the bill. I just wanted to kind of get a gauge to know what kind of communications went on between you and the Speaker's office on this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I wrote to the Speaker expressing concerns with the bill. In the process that resulted in the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments, I was not asked to participate in that process, which is...
You had no conversation regarding this bill with the Speaker's office?
Mr. Chairman, not that I can recall, no.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Dwayne or Ms. Simmons, do you have any desire to comment on the Dash 4 amendments and their drafting discussion that surrounded those? You can pass if you'd like. That's okay. Claudia House?
Good morning. I'm Claudia Howells. I manage ODOT's rail division. And with me is Craig Riley. Craig is manager of our crossing safety section. And I have your track.
Thank you very much, Claudia.
Maybe I'll go back and recap a little bit. You have my written testimony that was actually prepared last week. And for the record, these comments are equally applicable to the Dash 4 amendments. There was word within the Dash 3 amendments that we were uncomfortable with, and those changes were made in Dash 4. So assume that my comments relate to Dash 4. By way of background, the ODOT Rail Division, which now exists within the Department of Transportation, but obviously for almost 100 years was part of the Public Utility Commission, has had exclusive jurisdiction over all public highway railroad crossings in Oregon. Included within that, and for many, many years, that authority includes the responsibility for regulating the amount of time a train is allowed to block at the crossing. I'm going to walk through the bill a little bit and comment on each section so you know what our position is, because there's actually quite a bit in the bill. And I'm talking again to the Dash 4 amendments. By the way, I really want to express my appreciation to the Speaker and to Mrs. Simmons for working through a lot of issues that were presented in the original bill. And I also want to thank your staff for working with us to make sure that we ended up with something that I think for the most part we're very comfortable with. One of the first amendments allows an individual to petition the department to request an investigation for the length of time that a crossing may be blocked. We share some of the concern that the railroad has that by adding an individual, we may have actually opened that. We've opened the door very, very wide. As our fiscal impact statement indicates, a crossing, and not a crossing, but a contested case proceeding costs about $12,000 per proceeding. And if we ended up with a bunch of hearings out of this, that could be very, very costly. So that is probably the one area that we do continue to have some concerns.
Claudia, the fiscal that you just mentioned, do you have a copy of that? We don't have an updated fiscal on the amendment. The fiscal we have is on the original bill. I don't have a copy of a fiscal in my file.
We have a copy that was provided.
We can make some photocopies of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it on the amendment?
Pardon? It's on Dash 4 amendments. Yeah.
Thank
we
you.
Usually assume that LFO
yeah, passes. Yeah, usually they give them to us first.
Yeah. And I think we had this in on it timely. This changes the current criminal penalty to a civil penalty. We're actually very happy with that. That was a request we made in a bill that actually was introduced in the Senate, one of ODOT's pre-session filed bills. It also increases the penalty, or this bill increases the penalty from $3,000 to $5,000 and actually adds a minimum penalty level. We didn't have the minimum penalty within our first in our bill, but we did request an increase in the penalty, so that portion is entirely consistent with where we were headed. We do appreciate the railroad's concerns about that, but we do know that in some cases the $3,000 has not been effective in getting a change in behavior where we believe that there is the ability to, in fact, make operating changes. This establishes new authority to prohibit entirely any blockages at crossings when a blockage would present a significant threat to public safety, and it also establishes a new penalty. This is an area that I think is going to require quite a bit of work on our part and probably some administrative rules to establish exactly what criteria constitute significant threat. But we think that this is something that we can work with. Finally, it also establishes a new authority to regulate the distance from a public crossing that a railroad may park a train equipment, and establishes penalties. This is something that the railroads talked about. I think this is an area where we have significant experience. I don't think we'd go out and willy-nilly set distances just to confuse the railroad. That certainly would not be our function. As some, by way of background, the process actually allows that either party to an investigation or to a hearing has the right of appeal to the Court of Appeals. Any decision we make knowing full well that this can go to the Court of Appeals. And if we're dealing with interstate commerce, could actually end up in federal court. So the decisions we make knowing that we want them to stand up in court. We're not just going to go out and harass the railroads, or for that matter, ignore the needs of the public. So it's always a balancing act. Finally, this creates a new fund with revenues from penalties derived from violations of crossing blockage rules. This is actually something we've talked about for a long time. I think we'll have to see whether or not this fund accrues enough money to actually make it meaningful in terms of crossing improvements. The amount of money we get on an annual basis for improving crossings has not changed appreciably for 15 years, I guess. And that's about $2.2 million a year, and that doesn't go very far anymore. So any added revenue, we actually think is just fine. I think we did have a little bit of discomfort in the beginning. We are very proud of our crossing program, but that doesn't mean that what we have now is perfect. And I think we certainly value the insight of this body, and certainly the interest from Mrs. Simmons in improving crossing safety. We can always do our job better. If you have any questions, we're here. Craig's the expert, and actually began his railroad career as a conductor, so he knows a little bit about the real railroad world as well. Thank you.
Claudia, the uniform code, I don't know the acronym or all the lingo, but that Mr. Barrows referenced, can you just talk a little bit about how that, what kind of role that the uniform code will play as you go through this process?
Chair Starr, I think we're still working through how our process is going to be a little bit too, but railroads have operating practices, and by federal law, they are required to abide by them. My guess is that what we would do is simply adopt the 250 feet, and then by exception, at particular crossings, actually have a change in that 250 feet.
Craig, would you care to comment on that?
Chair Starr, I agree with what Claudia said, that we would probably start with the 250. It's proven well, it worked well in most locations. If there's a problem presented to us, we will go out and look at it, and we see that as just another tool in our toolbox to address crossing safety issues, and could apply, work with the railroad, or enforce the additional setback on them. But we would do it on a case-by-case basis.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Donner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding hearings, you cite one case in here that cost $12,000. Can you talk about that one, where it was, and a little bit about it?
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, that was actually a hearing related to Geckler Lane, which is the crossing that is of interest to the Speaker and Mrs. Simmons. This is a problem crossing in that trains do end up sitting as they approach into the yard.
Okay.
This was actually a hearing that was petitioned. There is a section of law that allows individuals to petition the department and to identify a crossing as dangerous. This is a very old statute. But that would not be unusual. That was, what, a day and a half?
Yes.
Day and a half hearing?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
What if the meeting were held here, the hearing was held in Salem? Wouldn't that save money? Couldn't you make them come in here?
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, it might. The policy, in fact, I think the law even says, though, that we're required to hold the hearing basically to accommodate the citizens who have requested it. So we go to them rather than having them come to us. But the major costs are not the travel costs. The major costs are the hiring of the hearings officer and the hiring of the court reporter, as well as our AG costs. So the travel costs are actually minimal. And that $12,000 did not include any of our staff time. That was simply what we paid out to pay for the hearings officer and the court reporter and that kind of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Claudia, three questions for you. How many times have you assessed the $3,000 maximum fine? in the last, say, 10 years?
Representative Starr, Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, in the last 10 years?
5 years?
A couple of years.
We actually,
a couple of years?
I think we actually provided that information to the Speaker, and I don't have a copy of it, unfortunately. And then I think she provided, or Mrs. Simmons provided that to you all. So I don't remember exactly. It's been, I need your help here. I was looking for that in my file and ended up not having it. Yes.
That, Mr. Chair, Claudia, that doesn't get to where I'm trying to go with the question. The question is how many times have you assessed a $3,000, which is the maximum penalty, and have you had to reassess it for a repeat offense by the same organization in the same spot?
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, yes, we have. In fact, most of those penalties are at one location.
Okay. All right.
Now, I want to add to that, though. That is the location that Carolyn Larson mentioned, and that is Albina Yard, where you have major conflict between a lot of truck moves and a lot of train moves that's into their main yard, and there are a series of crossings that are just chronically blocked. Some of it is just sort of an engineering problem. We do know, though, that when we do assess at a higher rate, we do get a little more compliance, and the number of crossings actually drop. So
Mr. Chair, if I may, Claudia, this is really one particular spot that you have this problem. You don't assess $3,000 fines all across the state on a regular basis or even an intermittent basis. It's really just one trouble spot.
Chair Representative Starr, I would say we have probably a half a dozen trouble spots.
Okay.
That sometimes they'll quiet down for a while, and we'll get back to certain things, and we have to go back and remind them that we're there.
Okay, and one last question, Mr. Chair, is this bill doesn't create a mandate for you to go out and reexamine every crossing where you might have double tracks and those types of things. This is going to be a complaint-driven process. Is that my understanding?
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, it is my understanding. We do know what crossings are double-tracked. That's already within our database. I think the one area that we actually don't know is where we have dead-end streets. That may be information we have to add or just simply make it complaint-driven.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, a person can petition the department, and the department has flexibility to decide whether it wants to hold a hearing.
Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, we don't have the discretion to say no if we get a valid legal petition under current law.
Then what is the difference between the status quo then and the changes under page 1, line 9, where person is added? And it says the department shall, after due investigation and hearing, what is the difference between the current law and this proposed change if a person has this right currently?
Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, I actually misspoke. The statute that allows for petitioning is a process that identifies a crossing as dangerous and therefore makes it a requirement for a county, interestingly enough, and I guess the state, to put in gates and lights. So it's very specific to that area.
I see. So this broadens
and I apologize.
The
it does.
Ability of a person to protect.
Yeah.
How difficult is it for, then, looking at the issue that's addressed here on Section 1, which is regulating the length of time a crossing may be blocked, how hard is it now for a person to obtain a hearing? Does a person have any standing? Do they just write a letter and ask the department to take a look at it?
Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, you know, I think as a practical matter, if we got what looked like a legitimate concern from a citizen, that we would follow up on our own. I think that's just our normal way of doing business. We also suggest to people that they talk to their local road authority, the city or county, so that the city or county can somewhat confirm there's a bigger issue. In terms of process, it's actually the road authority that makes application to vary from the normal or administrative rule, or the railroad can do that as well. But I think if we got repeat concerns, we would look at it.
Thank you.
You always do.
Representative Berger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Claudia, on this grade crossing safety improvement fund, did that idea come from ODOT, and was that a part of discussion with the railroad associations and people as well?
Chair Starr, Representative Verger, that really came out of discussions with the Speaker and Mrs. Simmons. Currently, those penalty monies actually offset the fee that's assessed on railroads, so it goes into the rail fund that funds our program. I think they were aware, and we had said that we had limited funding for crossing improvements, and it just came out of that discussion with them as a way to earmark, basically to earmark that penalty money for a specific purpose.
Has any discussion been had with the railroads about this particular tracking of the funds?
Chair Starr, Representative Verger, we certainly let them know that that came out of the discussions. I don't know if we have not had more than just casual discussion about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm an individual and I get into a dispute with a railroad, could I essentially create an endless series of hearings under the provisions under Section 1 and Section 4?
Chair Starr, Representative Merkley, that is one of our concerns, that the way it's written now, you could have someone who isn't even really affected by a crossing, per se, that would do that.
Thanks.
Under current law, a person who files a legal petition, you have to have a hearing. Could a person file a legal petition over and over again? A person has to have standing somehow, though, right?
I'm thinking back on that. Chair Starr, you mean in terms of identifying a crossing as dangerous? Theoretically, they could file over and over again.
Trying to figure out how different the amendment is from how the situation is today. Are there other questions? Anything else you'd like to add?
I will comment that as far as we know, the petition for a dangerous crossing has been used 2-3 times in anybody's memory. There were very few records. And that apparently is a statute that goes back to the 30s. It has not been used very much.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Close the public hearing. Wayne, do you want to? Do you want to testify? Okay, please.
Good morning, Chair Starr and members of the committee. My name for the record is Dwayne Bales with the Speaker's Office. I just wanted to clarify one point for the record. We did have a meeting with Mr. Cutter prior to drafting the Dash 3 amendments. And it's, if I recall correctly, we did provide a copy of the Dash 3 amendments to him afterwards. Now, he was not involved in actually the drafting of those amendments, the Dash 3 or Dash 4, but we did have a meeting, not in our office, but out in the hallway by the majority office, to listen to their concerns at their request. So we have had a dialogue going with the railroads on this issue. I just thought that was important to clarify.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think many of the changes you have made have addressed the significant concerns of the railroad. I remain a little troubled by the issue that the railroads have raised over the right of private action being expanded, and I could imagine that if I really wanted to be unpleasant with the railroad, I could challenge every crossing in the state, and then when I get through, I could start challenging them all over again. Is there any way in your mind that we could give people the ability to have reasonable chance to make sure there's a hearing, but avoid a situation where that right's abused? Is there any sort of a strategy or a language that you would be comfortable with addressing the railroad's concern of abuse of this right?
Chair Starr, and I represent Merkley, I think that's a good point. I think we would be open, obviously, to the committee's discussion on that.
If I can jump in here, Representative Merkley, if we change the word shall to may in the statute, would you support that?
Is that a more explicit maybe?
Which one?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chair Starr.
If you look at, where I read it, there's two places in the amendment. One of them's in statute already, in section 1, line 11, and then in section 4 of the amendments, line 21.
Okay. Chair Starr, I guess we would leave that up to the committee if they chose to do that.
Other questions? Anybody has additional comments? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else wish to testify on the bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3593. I think we want to have a little more discussion about this bill before we go to work session on it. So I will talk to the committee and we'll discuss it, and we'll bring the bill back for a work session at a later day. That will open a public hearing on House Bill 2145. John, will you give us an update on that bill, please?
Yes, Chair Starr, members of the committee, this is actually your first formal hearing. We had it put to tap on Friday. This is your first formal hearing on House Bill 2145, which removes the requirement that Oregon Department of Transportation assist Old Oregon Trail Association in erecting specified signs, provides civil penalties for certain violations of Motorist Information Act, authorizes the director of ODOT to seek injunctive relief against repeat violations of the Motorist Information Act. You have included in your packet a proposed -1 amendment. It does the following changes to the original bill. It changes the requirement in the hearing notice request. It must include issues to be raised and any accessories associated with the sign. It adds failure to report issues to be raised in hearing notice. It therefore requires those issues not to be raised during the hearing. It defines ownership interest. It expands statute violation for maximum civil penalty. It creates a new penalty for sign odor based on compensation amount owner receives. Also creates new provision for regulating vegetation, issuing permits, and allowing ODOT to establish a permit fee. Members, you should have a fiscal on this original bill. We do not have one yet on the amendment, of course, and there is no revenue impact on this bill. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you. Mr. Leitner and Mr. Sandblast.
Correct.
Yes. Welcome. You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Leitner with the Department of Transportation Project Administration. House Bill 2145 was introduced to do some housekeeping with the old Oregon Trail signs, and it was also introduced to correct a problem that we're experiencing with the outdoor advertising sign program. The old Oregon Trail Association doesn't exist anymore, And to have a statute that says we're supposed to put up signs in concert with them is inappropriate, and so we're asking that that portion be deleted from Oregon statute. The National Park Service already puts up the Oregon Trail signs, and we would certainly intend to have Oregon well situated with adequate Oregon Trail signs in the future. So the other sections of the bill deal with billboards, and on the House or the testimony of the that I've given you, there's some pictures of billboards to make sure we know what it is we're referring to. These four billboards that are shown on the testimony are illegal billboards. They're billboards that do not have permits. The business that put them up has said that they're not going to get a business license and that they're not going to observe Oregon's laws as far as billboards in Oregon. There are probably two dozen or more of these kinds of signs sprinkled between Medford and Portland at this time. The problem with Oregon law in this area is that it's a criminal penalty to erect a billboard, and the criminal penalty carries a $100 fine. I have found no one that's ever heard of that being enforced. It's absolutely unworkable. The bill, House Bill 2145, we propose to decriminalize the erection of these billboards and make them a civil penalty with a civil penalty structure that will be administered through administrative rule and will be very carefully done with the help of the sign industry. No rights of sign owners will be changed in this conversion. An owner will still retain all the rights to hearings, any court appeals, or any other appeal in whatever venue is possible. We have some that are appealed to U.S. District Court, U.S. District Court of Appeals, so there are plenty of avenues to pursue if a person has objections to the program. What the bill does is it accomplishes and protects legitimate business sign operators from repeated illegal installations by these companies that basically say the Oregon law doesn't apply to them. There are the Dash 1 amendments, which reflect agreement between ODOT and the outdoor advertising industry on this bill and refine some of the points, and Mr. Leon touched on those in his summary. One provision that has been added, it does allow a sign owner to go out into the right-of-way and trim trees and brush in certain circumstances. It would be done under a permit. It would not be allowed in an area of designated scenic area, and the permits would be issued by the Highway Division. I would ask your support of the Dash 1 amendments and recommend that the bill be sent to the floor with a due pass. I'll answer questions. I believe Mr. Sandblast should.
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, my name is Terry Sandblast. I'm the president of the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association. The industry is represented by members that have businesses throughout the state, Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, as well as Northwestern Oregon. We have had numerous discussions with the Highway Department regarding this particular bill and also another bill that's pending in the legislature, Senate Bill 889, I believe, which is a bill to discuss fees, increasing fees that we need to take a look at. The major part of this bill is how we structure penalties. They've changed from criminal to civil, and we are supportive of that, and I've provided you a letter dated April 18th, and I'll just briefly read that into the record. The Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association represents industry members throughout the state that operate outdoor advertising signs. Our goal is to work cooperatively with the legislature to improve the Oregon Motors Information Act and streamline the operation of outdoor advertising. This bill was initially proposed by the Oregon Department of Transportation and suggested certain modifications to existing legislation pertaining to the permitting of outdoor advertising signs under the Oregon Motorist Information Act. Association representatives had numerous discussions with ODOT officials and received comments from our membership. We are pleased to report that the bill as amended is acceptable to the association. House Bill 2145, as amended, clarifies certain provisions of ORS Chapter 377 and allows ODOT to pursue certain alleged violators in an administrative arena. House Bill 2145, as amended, does not purport to change in any respect the constitutional rights held by sign owners and others engaged in free speech and is protected by the Constitution, and particularly their rights to bring suit in court. Section 3.1b of amended HB 2145 provides no maximum civil penalty for a sign owner that violates ORS 377.725. Further, it specifically provides that the maximum amount will be established by department rule. We feel confident that the rulemaking process will determine what constitutes good faith defenses to this provision, and we look forward to participating in that process. However, if we are unsuccessful in obtaining workable rules, the association will return next legislative session or in other future sessions seeking an amendment of Section 3.1b to provide for judicial processing relating to ORS 377.725. Primarily, the impact of the amendments is to address those individuals or those firms that violate the Oregon Motorist Information Act by not obtaining the required permit. And we believe as an industry that permits should be acquired, and we also believe that if there are good faith arguments, that those should be allowed without severe penalty. And I think that's the discussion we will have in setting up the administrative rules. Glad to answer any questions you may have.
Well, let me try to get this square in my own mind. Billboard company wants to put up billboard on the next highway. In order to construct that billboard, they have to go to the local jurisdiction, I assume, to get a building permit in order to do that. And under the Oregon Motorist Information Act, they're supposed to come to the ODOT as well to get a permit. Is that correct?
Chair Starr, the permits that are available are all out there now. ODOT does not issue any more permits. There's approximately 2,200 permits that have been issued in Oregon. There are about 1,800 that are up on billboards right now. So there are 400 permits that are out there in circulation somewhere. They're renewed, but they're not up on billboards. And yes, if there are local zoning or building requirements, we do not permit a billboard to go up unless it complies with local regulations.
Let me work that again.
Okay.
A billboard company has a spot next to a highway in Oregon. They want to build a billboard. They want to put a billboard up. They get all the necessary, it's zoned appropriately at the local level. They get all the necessary local permits in order to construct it. They, in addition to that, have to have a permit from ODOT in order to construct that billboard. And that's what we're talking about here in this bill, is making sure that they have the appropriate permit from ODOT. Currently, there's 400 of them that are somewhere floating around. Probably somebody could buy from someone.
Chair Starr, that's correct. They would have to obtain it from someone who already has one of those permits.
The problem that we're trying to address here in this bill is that you have billboard companies out there who are building billboards without those permits, though they probably are following the local building code or building permitting process.
Chair Starr, that's correct.
Other questions?
In the law, there's a $100 fine, but there's also 30 days in jail. If you threw one of these guys in jail earlier, would the people quit putting the signs up?
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, we have never been able to convince anyone at the Department of Justice that they could ever prosecute anyone for 30 days in jail as a criminal penalty for putting up one of these signs. In words, it sounds like it might work. In practice, it never has.
Why did they pass the law, right? I think it would have worked.
Mr. White, have you ever tried?
Chair Starr, yes, I have asked, and I have been told that it will not work.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2145? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2145. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2145.
Mr. Chairman, move the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Devlin has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2145. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2145 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Merkley has moved.
I'm the younger one. That's the older one.
I've been practicing projecting my voice.
I'm just looking at that system to make sure we're okay here. Representative Devlin moves. I'm sorry. Representative Devlin moves House Bill 2145 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. The discussion on the motion.
Senator, I have one question, Mr. Chair. How does that affect our sign down at Kaiser at the Volcano Stadium?
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, it will not affect that sign. Yep.
Thank you. Right. Any comments, questions? We have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Yes.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Donner?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. Motion passed. Do you have a volunteer to carry that bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Berger will carry.
Sure.
Close the work session on House Bill 2145. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3411. John, can you give us the heads up on this bill? We've got an additional amendment that this was delivered.
Right. Chair, members of the committee, we have before us again House Bill 3411. We had a hearing on April 23rd on this bill. It is known as the rate mile simplification bill. Just to review, it creates four major changes in the current weight mile tax system. It authorizes ODOT to allow quarterly reporting and the payment of tax bonds to be optional based upon a truck company's payment performance. Also eliminates the weight mile tax plate that are unique only in Oregon, creates new requirements for education among motor carriers. The Dash 3 amendment, all it does is combine, we had also in the last hearing the Dash 1 amendment, which scheduled a date effective on July 1st, 2002, and the Dash 2, which was just some simple technical changes. The Dash 3 that you have before you, members, is just a combination of the Dash 1 and Dash 2 and expedites our paper process so we can get our fiscal a little bit more time there.
Very good. This bill then goes to the floor with this bill?
Yes.
Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Move the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Devlin, move the Dash 3 amendments to the House Bill 3411. Is there questions, comments? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Move 3411 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 3411 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? There are questions, comments? Let's have a roll call vote, Kevin.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Zahner?
Get a good vote.
Maybe.
Aye.
Just vote yes.
Aye. Motion passed. Let's carry the bill. Let's carry this bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3411. Representative Krupp, would you wish to vote on House Bill 2145?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I would.
Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2145. The motion on the floor is to send the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. How do you vote?
Yes.
Representative Krupp votes yes. Close the work session on House Bill 2145.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The other bills on our agenda today, we're still in the process of working out the kink of them. So we're not going to go to work session on those two bills. So with that, we are done. Thank you very much, everyone.